Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Board of Supervisors. It's Thursday, September 20th, 2018. It's 8:30, and we're in the Community Center of the Sierra Room at 851 East William Street here in Carson City. Kathy, will you do roll call?
Good morning. Supervisor Bonkowski. Supervisor Bagwell.
Here.
Supervisor Barrett. Mayor Kroll. And Mayor Pro Temp About. We have a quorum.
May I call on Mark Sear from the Salvation Army to lead us this morning in a prayer.
Good morning. Let's pray. My Heavenly Father, we come to you with thankfulness for the blessings you give us. We thank you for our city leaders and their faithfulness. We ask you to be with them and bless them. Be with our law enforcement, our firefighters, and our city employees as well. We ask that you fill them with your wisdom and strength. Guide them as they serve us and unite them together as one voice for what is best for our city and its people. Give them courage, vision, wisdom, and truth. Father, we pray these things in the precious name of Jesus. Amen.
Moving on, is there any public comment at this point in time, unrelated to anything else that's on the agenda? All right, seeing none, item 6 is adoption of the agenda. I am under the understanding that we're going to pull items 11A and 12 for discussion off the agenda. Otherwise, any other changes? Then we'll agenda as published. And as amended. And now we're going to step down to the front of the podium here for a length of service award. The first longevity award is to Frankie Haynes, who's the Victim Witness Program Administrator. Come on up, Frankie. And I have the pleasure of serving with you on SART. You do a great job, so thank you for your service. And this is in recognition and appreciation for 10 years of continuous dedication to the service for Carson City. And we really appreciate everything that you do. Thank you. You want to say anything? Frankie, you don't get off that easy. Rachel Percari, where are you? The smiling face in the city offices. Rachel, first of all, in my heart, thank you for everything that you do. Really appreciate you. And this award is as office specialist in recognition and appreciation for 5 years of continuous dedication to service for Carson City. Thank you so much. Okay. Richard Hardcastle. Hi, Richard. Morning. Richard works for Fleet Services. He's a Fleet Services foreman. And this is in recognition and appreciation for 10 years of continuous dedication to service for Carson City. We really appreciate everything you do. Thank you. Cherie Santillo. Good morning, Cherie. It's with pleasure that I present this to you as administrative assistant in recognition and appreciation for 20 years, that time went by fast, of continuous dedication and service to Carson City. Thank you so much. And Fred Wall. Good morning, Fred. And it's with pleasure, as captain, that I present you in recognition and appreciation for 25 years of continuous dedication to service for Carson City. Thank you for everything you do. I don't know how you do what you do. Thank you. Appreciate it. Moving on, we're at the consent agenda. Do I have a motion on the consent agenda?
I move to approve the consent agenda consisting of items 8A, 9A, 10A, and 11B.
Second. Motion is second. All those in favor? Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right, thank you. All right, now we'll go back to item 11A. This is to approve the purchase of prescription medications for persons detained in the Carson City Jail through a joinder contract with Diamond Pharmacy. Nikki, do you want to elaborate on this?
Good morning. Nikki Ager, Director of Carson City Health and Human Services. So we have had Diamond Pharmacy as our contract provider for a number of years, and we are asking today to join on with their joinder contract for the MCAP, which gives us special pricing.
Board questions?
Yeah, I'll start, Nikki. So this item comes before us every year, every other year, and we have seen a dramatic increase in the value of the contract in the number and cost of the prescriptions. Can you kind of walk through that process and tell us what's going on? The last time this was in front of us, the board had asked for an analysis of the program in the jail so that we had a better understanding of what's going on. Why is the cost going up so rapidly? Why are so many more prescriptions being passed out and so on? So can you walk us through that, please?
Okay, so the population in the jail, as we know, I mean, they require more intensive medical care, and that includes the medications. What I've seen over the past 3 years is what we look at is about 30% of the individuals that receive medications make up anywhere from 54 to 58% of the cost. So it's the type of medications that they're on. There's a number of inhalers, and that's to help with the lungs and that, and the breathing, that are expensive. A number of mental health medications that are expensive. We've had some outlier medications that are very expensive related to the individual being on chemo at one point or another. What I'm hoping through this joinder contract is that it will reduce our cost of medications. And I have seen that we use the MCAP contract in the clinic, and I have seen where the medications are less expensive. So that's kind of a explanation of why, you know, we're just getting sicker people in the jail.
Do we have the ability to substitute generics?
Yes, and they do when possible. We have now started a process that we copy the nurse practitioner that's in the jail on the bill coming from Diamond Pharmacy so that she's aware of what the medications cost. Sometimes with the mental health medications, it's hard to, you can't change those medications right in the middle of treatment. Some medications work much better than others. So with those medications, sometimes we're not able to switch.
Do the generics, are they purchased under the Diamond Pharmacy contract as well, or do we have to get those from another vendor?
All of the medications that we give are under Diamond Pharmacy unless it's a very emergency medication such as we need something right now, but that doesn't happen very often anymore.
And so looking at the trends, and you've kind of gone over the last 3 years, where do you see this expense going? Are there any mitigation measures that we can put into place that would help? You know, just kind of give us an idea of what we're looking at in the future.
So the mitigation that I'm working on, hopefully this joinder contract will help. And then also, like I had mentioned just recently, we're including that APRN into the process so that she's aware of the cost, and we're able, then she can look at different medications that may be less expensive. And I'll be continuing to monitor this monthly, definitely, as we go on. And I can, this joinder contract is only through December 31st, 2019, so I'll be back. And then I can also report on how we're doing with the joinder contract.
And then finally, based on actual expenses paid over the last 2 years, my understanding is that we could probably reduce this contract to $130,000 instead of $150,000. So I would like some input from the other board members on that, whether they'd like to discuss that.
So just a couple of items. I had a discussion with you concerning some data points to help us with some information. So is that something you think towards the future we can start tracking? I'm really after like a cost per average inmate, some things to look to determine if it's the population in the jail. You know, as that goes up, is it a cost element because we have five more guests in our jail, or, you know, so are you going to be able, do you think, start tracking a little more so we can start maybe pinpointing the part of the direct issues?
Yes, and pursuant to our conversation, yeah, I'm going to start October 1st once we start with this joinder contract, and moving forward, okay, that will be one of the data points that we're looking at, and I'll continue to also track how I'm tracking, you know, what percentage of the population is receiving most of the medications.
Because I'd really appreciate that, because I think it'll help us get a hand, maybe, or better, a bigger picture of the issue. And then as far as the contract amount, I'm not sure that it behooves us to be concerned whether it's $135,000 or $156,000. Because I think you only do it by prescription. So it's only, I hate for you to have to come back and say we overspent it by $200 when it's a mandate, we have to provide the care. So I guess my question to you is, if you're comfortable, I'm okay with going down to 135 or something, but I'm not sure I see any. It's not one you buy extras and over, yeah, it's a person-to-person prescription, right?
Yeah, the only extras that are purchased are for the jail, and that does not amount to a huge amount, and that's medication that they can have on hand. So yeah, most of it is per individual prescription. Correct. And not extras.
Right. So I don't see them buying a bulk volume or something to spend the extra $20,000. That's the point.
And my goal is with this jointer contract that we're going to be spending a lot less, hopefully.
Thank you, Nikki. Is there any further board comment on this? Public comment? All right, seeing none, then I will bring it back to the board. It's your pleasure.
Okay. I move to approve the purchase of prescription medications through the jointer contract with Diamond Pharmacy for a not-to-exceed amount of $156,250 beginning October 1, 2018 through December 31st, 2019.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor? Aye. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now going to item 12A, to adopt a resolution pursuant to NRS 277050, approving the intent to lease approximately 2,330 square feet of the Carson City Sheriff's Office to the State of Nevada's Public Works Division as the lessee in the Department of Public Safety's Highway Patrol Division. Are you going to take us through this today?
I'm going to do my best, ma'am. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jerome Tashbant. I'm the Assistant Sheriff here in Carson City. Since August of 2015, the Sheriff's Department has leased about 2,300 square feet out to the State of Nevada Department of Public Safety Highway Patrol in a collaborative win-win type of situation where Highway Patrol is working out of the Sheriff's Office. We are looking to continue that contract for another 4 years. We're currently in negotiations with the state for the exact amount. Per the NRS, we have to come to you with a resolution, a public notice in the newspapers, and then a public hearing comment period, not less than 2 weeks later. And then we can talk about what the final contract looks like at that point. I'm available for any questions.
All right. So by what you're saying, the lease amount per square foot, which is extremely low, is being discussed.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Brad?
Brad, I had asked for this item to be pulled since it was on the consent agenda because I want to have a discussion about it. The initial lease, which was for 3 years, had no accelerators in it. In other words, there was no increases in the rate during that three-year period. This version of the lease also has no annual increases or biannual increases. At the time that we did the original lease 3 years ago, the rate was at or slightly below at what would be considered market at that time, but now it's at least 50% below what would be considered market. So I understand the process that we have to go through where we approve the resolution of the intent to lease, and I don't have any issue with that, but I just want to put on the record so that you have something to guide you in your negotiations that I personally am looking for something that's in that $1.50 a foot full service with at least biannual increases. And this is pretty standard for buildings and grounds to negotiate at the state level. So we shouldn't have a whole lot of pushback on it. There's no place in Carson City that Highway Patrol is going to be able to go to get a better location at a better rate. It is just not out there. So I just want to make sure that we're maximizing the revenue that we can get and still be fair. It's a great cohabitation between the Sheriff's Office and the Highway Patrol. I'd like to see it continue, but I want to make sure that we get you guys as much revenue as we can.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
And just as a comment, if my memory serves me right, I think we also let them move in where we didn't charge them for a while before we got that initial lease put together. So I think the city's been very accommodating, and I agree with Brad that it's a good mix there. I think it's good for the Highway Patrol and it's good for Carson City, so I certainly support the intent to lease, but we definitely need to shore up the dollar amount better.
I absolutely agree. It's a very unique relationship, and it's been very positive, and I do appreciate the feedback from the board.
Thank you, Jerome. Any other board comment? Any public comment on this? Seeing none, board?
Resolution number?
2018-R28.
I move to adopt resolution 2018-R28 pursuant to NRS 277.050, approving the intent to lease approximately 2,330 square feet of the Carson City Sheriff's Office to the State of Nevada Public Works Division as the lessee, and the Department of Public Safety's Nevada Highway Patrol as the tenant.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Thank you. Moving on to item 14A, to approve the purchases of radio equipment, including replacement radio parts and accessories through a joinder contract with Motorola Solutions, etc. James, you're going to take us through this one.
Good morning, Supervisors. James Jacklett, Operations Manager, Carson City Public Works. This item will allow us to effectively purchase replacement radio equipment and parts from Motorola Solutions and Harris Corporation through Daily Wells, their exclusive distributor, as budgeted in both the Fleet Radio Equipment Fund and in accordance with various department requests as anticipated.
Brad, did you have questions?
Hey, James. We approved in the CIP quite a bit of money for radio replacement. Can you tell us where we're at now, assuming that this item is approved? Where are we at in that total replacement program, though?
Yes, so in the CIP this year, we had this money actually with subscriber radio replacement is coming from the Technical Equipment Operating Fund, for the most part, which is 0676 out of Fleet Radio. There was just over 436,000 budgeted for this purpose, and the primary purpose for this is to replace those subscriber end-user radios that are carried on the person or fixed in vehicles. There are also additional CIP improvements we're working on, which are the console replacement, which is the server and the computerized central infrastructure system, and then continued investment in infrastructure improvements at Sugarloaf, and those items are covered under capital.
But how far along into these are we with all the replacements? How much work do we have left?
Yeah, so there is quite a bit of work left. Where we've been, just an update to previous items, we were watching regional partners, meeting with them. We were watching the Nevada Shared Radio System, NDOT, NV Energy, and Washoe County Communications. We're trying to see where they were going to go. The NSRS, which is collectively NV Energy, NDOT, and Washoe County, they went with and selected Harris Corporation through their RFP process. They're still in the midst of negotiating their purchasing agreement. In the future, I would anticipate that if it can offer better than a 30% discount that we're getting through the LA City joinder via this, that we would look to join with them. So right now, the region around us is Motorola and Harris. What I'm trying to do is make sure that for every solution, for every end user, we're evaluating the best possible equipment, commoditizing it as much as possible, and delivering what they need without just buying the most expensive thing just because it's what we prefer to use. So there's still a significant amount of work to do regionally to figure out how we're going to move forward, make improvements, and continue to talk with everybody. These are complex issues. We can't take a step in any direction without basically breaking something. So a lot of team building, a lot of work with our regional partners. This year I was successful in getting three additional repeated frequency licenses that we're working to activate, and that should add the needed capacity and redundancy that we need. The CIP request that I put in last year, we weren't, of course, able to get all the money that we requested. I'm competing with general fund and the other requirements. So at this point, we're doing everything we can to evaluate solutions and see if we can turn that on and activate that functionality at the lowest dollar amount. That's causing us to be creative. I was set back in June. My communications technician resigned and went to Washoe County. In August, middle of August, we brought a new communication tech on board. We only have one, so I'm split among other tasks as well. So we're realigned with a purpose. Our goal is still to, with the radio user group, to add capacity, redundancy, and look towards the future for interoperability and the best use of our tax dollars and enterprise funds.
I think I just want to be refreshed slightly on this. Aren't we looking to set up a recurring dollar? Like, wasn't it off the top of my head, I think 10% of the radios that we would be having dollars in the fund, so kind of like we set up vehicles, you know, and things that we're not going to get these huge ticket maybe other than a swap of the system itself. But so we are doing the percentage of radio replacements so that the bad ones can come offline and people have communication, if I recall.
Yes, thank you for the question. That's exactly what this technical equipment line item is for. I requested a little bit more. I requested close to $460,000 for radio replacement. That was reduced, and the capital request that I had for repeater equipment was pulled out of there. Also, to add in there, we are still looking at functional improvements. The fire department would like an additional repeated channel, so figuring that's part of bringing those other repeaters online. There's a lot of moving pieces, but my challenge and my goal is to make the best use of this this money. I plan on doing that by using the cheapest equipment I can. So to give you an example, a practical example, we're looking at replacing some tier two, which for us tier two are non-public safety, so these aren't cops, these aren't firemen, but public works or landfill or secondary use vehicles. We're looking at replacing some of those radios for less than 50% of what we previously purchased radios for. So by making smart decisions like that, as long as it meets the requirements of the end user and aligns with our objectives, that's how I'm planning to recover funding to then go back in and add that functional capacity that wasn't budgeted.
James, can I ask you a question about something that you mentioned in terms of maybe aligning with other counties in terms of the contracts they're negotiating? Isn't there an increased cost if we switch out equipment to something else?
So, yes, a switch, there are so many options. So it's very difficult to pin down an exact cost. However, a forklift refresh would be expensive. So my goal is to try to make sure that we're every dollar that we're spending, we're either minimizing that cost or we're aligning it with some future ability to switch over. So one example of how we're doing that is evaluation of multiband radios for portables. So if I'm able to buy multiband radios that would support the Washoe County and NSRS system, as well as our system today, then that reduces the chances of us having to go back in and do a forklift replacement of all subscriber radios. That's not always cost effective. With some it is, with others it's not. But with promotions, I have been able to successfully buy multiband radios for less than we were buying single band radios for. So when possible, when everything lines up, we're making those steps, and otherwise I'm minimizing our investment so that if it's determined that our most effective use of dollars would be to join with others, that we're not throwing away a new system.
And James, comment that you made about looking at less expensive options. When you analyze a purchase like that, do you also take into account life expectancy of the equipment? And so you balance it out. So even though we may be paying more initially for a piece of equipment, because it has a longer life expectancy, it's actually a better deal for the city?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's something that's very unclear right now. With the evolution of FirstNet, with public safety, broadband network, and LTE, we don't really know what systems are going to be in 10 years. It used to be 20, 30 years ago when you bought a radio that that radio, nothing was going to change. At our previous upgrade cycles had been forced by the FCC narrowband mandate and then through P25 compliance, again through the feds. At this point, there's no immediate regulatory push or change for us. I think the next one will be a technology change. The system and those solutions are going to come up, and we're going to replace those. So that's why we targeted that 10-year replacement cycle. That's an effective, reasonable timeline. However, as these devices become more and more computer-like, that will probably reduce, and we'll probably get to a 5 to 7 year refresh cycle. And I'm hoping that the cost will go down when that happens, but that's not where things are going.
Thank you, James, for your prudent approach. Appreciate it. Any other board questions? Any public comment? All right, seeing none, board.
I move to approve the joiner contracts with Motorola Solutions and Daily Wells Communications, Inc. for an amount not to exceed $500,000 through June 30th, 2019.
Motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. Thank you. On to item 15A, fire, to accept in place of the business impact statement on file with the board with the finding that proposed changes to CCMC Title 14, Chapter 14.02, do not impose a direct and significant economic burden on a business and or do not directly restrict the formation, operation, or expansion of business. So, Dave, Iris, are you going to take us through this?
So we're both going to speak, but I'll have him start with an introduction of what we're doing, and then I'll go into the other part.
For the record, Dave Rubin, Battalion Chief Fire Marshal from the Fire Department. This is part of a six-year code adoption process. The last time we adopted the 2012 codes was back in 2013. And regionally, it's been decided instead of an every three-year adoption, the codes come out every 3 years, we were going to go to an every six-year adoption. And so now it's 2018, 6 years has passed, and here we are. So ourselves, along with the building department, you'll be seeing them probably later in the year, are adopting the new code sets. As part of that, we did some outreach to various impacted groups. As part of the business impact statement. Do you want to talk?
So, Iris Yowell, for the record. I always feel so weird introducing myself every time because you guys know me, but I know it's part of the deal. So, pursuant to NRS Chapter 237, we have to do this business impact statement just so that we can reach out to businesses and determine whether a burden is going to be placed on those businesses. And so we started the outreach in July of 2018, but that was different than the business impact analysis itself, than the statutory requirement. So it started with meetings. Dave was very, very proactive doing this and started in July. And then on August, a bunch of letters went out, which is what we do as part of this process. And then we didn't receive any comments, not one single comment, which was kind of surprising as part of the process, but probably it's because most of the changes are going to be positive, or the majority is positive and will make it easier on at least businesses to operate. Of course, Dave can go more into that later, but so we're just asking you to make a finding that the proposed changes do not burden businesses, and the exact language, of course, is, I will read it, do not impose a direct and significant economic burden on a business and or, of course, you have a choice, do not directly restrict the formation, operation, or expansion of a business. Questions?
And one thing I'd like to add, there's no proposed fee increases or new fees or anything like that. There are some new operational permits required by the new codes, but we don't charge for them. As an example, food trucks, we've been inspecting those as part of the city business license program, and now the codes actually require the fire codes because of different fires and things that have happened require us to issue and do inspections on food trucks. So we'll do that and issue them a permit, but there's no fee. We don't charge any fees. So there's no, we're not raising any of the existing permit fees for construction, and we're not imposing any new fees.
We were just being really cautious in this business impact statement just to make sure that, as Mr. Rubin was saying, is that there aren't any fees that are going to be increased at this time, but it's possible in the next 6 years that that could happen in theory. So a lot of times that would be the basis for a burden to be imposed on a business. And so that's why we did the business impact statement.
And so the actual implementation of the regulations don't cause a burden either? I mean, by adopting it, they don't have to go to some stricter standard that means the piping that used to cost $1,000 for a house now costs $2,000? Is there no impact on?
No.
None? Oh.
Yeah, I had a similar question to Lori's. Not for existing business, which is the way this is worded, and I think where we have to make the finding, but for residents, I think that there's an impact that could have an additional cost, and certainly for new construction, there's going to be some additional code requirements that I think will add cost to a project. So, you know, I think that we can make this finding, but on this item and the next item, I'd just like to put on the record for the public's benefit that there could be some impacts coming forward that they're going to have to be aware of and they're going to have to deal with going forward. And I was talking to the chief earlier before the meeting, and this is all about trying to find the balance. So we have an obligation for public safety, but at the same time, we have an obligation not to overregulate or overburden residents and business. And for me, it's very difficult to try to find that middle ground between the two. And so that's my concern. And on the next item, there's a whole list of things that we'll go through and talk about that kind of relate to that. But as far as the impact, the business impact statement goes, I understand where we're going with that. So thank you.
And my only question is, with regards to remodel and retrofit, what that expense will be going forward, because that's always a surprise, you know, especially, correct, to comply to a new code and that sort of thing. So any comment with regards to impact as it relates to that?
Dave Rubin, I can't think off the top of my head any changes that would impact any residential remodeling.
How about commercial business?
I can't think really of anything off the top of my head. There's stuff related to, I mean, things that are different from the last code. I mean, there may be some in there. I mean, the book's pretty big. But I can't think off the top of my head any substantive significant cost changes.
And just remember, there was so much notice out to businesses and potentially affected parties, so we didn't receive any comments, and so there is that legal basis to find that it doesn't impose the burden.
My only comment to that is sometimes people don't realize the pickle they're in until they're in it.
Totally understand.
So. Any other board comments? Any public comment with regards to this? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board.
I move to accept and place the business impact statement on file with this board with a finding that the proposed changes to Carson City Municipal Code Title 14, Chapter 14.02, do not impose a direct and significant economic burden on a business or do not directly restrict the formation, operation, or expansion of a business.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Thank you.
Okay. I just a comment on record just to be sure that the board is relying on the fact that the experts that this will impact have not given us any statement to the contrary, so we adopted the intent, but I'm a little bit with Karen there that they may not realize till they go to double the size of a room or so. Anyway, just putting that on the record.
Okay, thank you for that, Lori. And as we move forward on to item 15B, I think we want to bring into it the discussion that we had on the previous agenda item. And this is to introduce on first reading an ordinance amending sections of Title 14, Chapter 14.02 to reflect the adoption of the 2018 editions of the International Fire Code and the International Wildland Urban Interface Code and the Northern Nevada Fire Amendments. So if you just want to walk us through what we're doing, and then I'm sure there will be a lot of questions.
Sure. Dave Rubin for the record. Back in 2012, regionally, we started an approach where all the fire departments in the area worked together to come up with amendment packages. So there would be one package of modifications to the fire code. We all use the same fire code. The state sets the base code. Currently, they're also on the 2012. They're going to be moving to the 2018 code, hopefully in January of 2019. When that happens, we all have to follow that code. So if we don't make any modifications to it, then we're stuck with just what the state has. And obviously, there's a lot of difference between Las Vegas and Lake Mead and you know, our area. So this takes into consideration local things related to climate, staffing levels, things like that. So we've worked together regionally to make a document that makes it easier for the contractors and business folks. So whether they're doing business in Washoe County or Douglas County or Lyon, the basic framework is the same. So they're not looking at a different adoption in every jurisdiction. So that's where we started from. We started working on this beginning of this year, had numerous meetings. Like we said earlier, we had a lot of different outreach. We had an outreach meeting with the Builders Association of Northern Nevada and Nevada Business or Builders Alliance with Aaron West. Basically had pretty positive response, didn't receive any written feedback. Same thing with the chamber and all the stuff we talked about the last agenda item. So where we're at now is the documents. First thing we need to do as part of this ordinance is adopt the new codes. And this is the first reading for it. This would go into effect January 1st. As part of that, like I said, instead of having our own little changes to it, we have this regional package that's a consensus document for the Wildland Urban Interface Code as well as the International Fire Code. And so this would be the first reading of it. Happy to answer any questions, and then we would have the second reading at your next board meeting.
Nancy, did you want to go over the changes that you requested first?
All the ones that I requested were already incorporated into the document.
Okay. So, Dave, I have a whole long list, which you've already seen, and I just want to go through them to put them on the record, an explanation. So I'll just start down the list, and then you can give me the explanation that you've already given me, just for the general public, the benefit of the general public. So section 202, which is on the first page, I believe. The height in the definition of a high-rise building is being lowered from 75 feet above fire vehicle access to 55 feet. Can you walk us through what the thought process was for that?
Sure. Like several other items in here, that's actually in state law, in NAC 477.283, the state fire marshal adoptions of the state code, and that is an outcome of the MGM fires and the other high-rise fires in the early 80s. So the state appointed a governor's committee, and at that time, for a variety of reasons, decrease the high-rise height from 75 to 55 feet and has been that way in state law ever since. So there's that along with some other items in here in the amendments. We mirror state law, and while we don't like to duplicate other statutes, we're trying to put the most commonly used things in this so when contractors can look at one place instead of having to look at six different places. So that's why it's in there.
And this will also relate to location of firefighting equipment rooms within a high-rise, the height of a building?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
So there's a requirement in the fire code that a fire equipment room, supply room, is built into a building above a certain height. And so is that a different section of the code, or does that also go with the 55-foot height limit?
So by dropping the height from 75 to 55 feet, all the high-rise requirements, whether it's backup power or fire equipment room, anything like that, are triggered over 55 feet.
Okay, my next item is section 308.4.3, and that is portable outdoor fireplaces. So this would prohibit the use of a portable outdoor fireplace within 15 feet of a structure or combustible materials. And my concern is that there's a lot of residential properties that have decks that have barbecues or fire pits on them. And so I just want to have an understanding, is does that prohibit the use of these devices on a deck or within 15 feet of the structure being the house? Or is that something that is just not really enforceable in the code?
Kind of both. So obviously we're not out being the fireplace police. The consensus of the committee was to eliminate it because it was difficult to enforce, and the fact that if you were to go buy one of those portable fire pits from Lowe's, they always require that they're not operated on combustible surfaces. So anything that you're using is supposed to be used with the manufacturer's instructions. So if you're operating on a combustible deck, you're already, this kind of duplicates the fact you're already violating the way the manufacturer said to use it. So if there is a fire hazard of it, if we got called to the house because you have 10-foot flames coming up and you're using this thing on your combustible deck, we already have the authority to tell you to, you need to put it out. So it kind of duplicated that, and that was the committee's feeling.
So do you think this is more of a educational part of the code? Because the reality is that that's exactly where people are going to use them, is on a deck.
Yeah, so when we go out, if we were to get a call at your house because you had your neighbors called because you had big flames and you're using this on your deck, we're not issuing you a citation or anything. It's just it's an education thing.
Dave, should there be something added in there, at least in projects that I do up at the lake, they're required to have at least a cage screen over any fire pit so that, you know, it doesn't completely eliminate, but it does mitigate any sparks.
If they're in a wildland urban interface area, the WUI code already requires that. And most of the ones I see at Lowe's or Home Depot or any of those places do come with a mesh screen over them.
The next item is 507.3, fire flow. Subject to approval of the fire authority, the required fire flow is not available for fire protection, an automatic fire sprinkler shall be installed. So this gives the fire department the sole authority to require a sprinkler system if they determine that there's not adequate fire flow. Or am I not reading that correctly?
Nope. The amended section in the amendments just mirrors what's in NAC 477, same thing where we have to mirror it.
So that's a state requirement that we're just mirroring?
Correct.
No, there's no square footage attached to that. It's based on fire flow, available fire flow.
Correct. So if you were to build a building in a rural area and there's no fire hydrants, or some of the rural areas in Nevada, they might, the fire hydrants might be supplied by a 2-inch pipe instead of a 6-inch like code's required. And so this provides for, even if there's hydrants there, if they're not adequately supplied, that we wouldn't recognize them, and you'd have to put sprinklers in. We don't. It's not really an issue that affects us. Again, it's just mirroring what state law says.
So Karen's question was, this supersedes the 5,000 square foot requirement.
Okay. It does. And like I said, that's only in areas that would not have the fire flow.
Would it apply to, say, urban areas that have low water pressure and don't have adequate fire flow?
It could. Like I said, we haven't had an issue with all the construction we have going on in the last 5 years. I can't think of a time where we had to apply this.
The next section is 508.1.6, subsection 19, which is HVAC, lighting, telephone lines, and power disconnects. So now there has to be a separate room or backup power to these items, so that in the case of a fire, that you guys have a command room and that communications. Is that correct?
There's already a requirement for high-rise buildings, which is all that this applies to. For high-rise buildings, have to have a command room, and this just ensures that it has a habitable environment. That's where the incident commander is going to work. And again, this is a consensus document, so it's covering everything from winter conditions at Lake Tahoe to down here Arena, where it's 100 degrees out. So it just provides that the firefighters are able to work. They're not in a 110 or 120 degree room or a minus 10 degree room at Lake Tahoe. Some of the when I worked at Lake Tahoe, some of the high rises, the command rooms open to the outside. So basically we're standing outside. So this just ensures it has the habitable room.
Dave, is that where the new required DOS systems will live as well, so that there's communication for you?
Nope, that is a totally separate thing.
Next item is 510.1, which also applies to high-rise buildings, and this has to do with emergency radio coverage.
So I think, are you talking about number three?
Well, I had looked at all three, 1, 2, and 3, but I think, yes, it's the technical report for radio coverage, emergency radio coverage.
So this applies to any new building, and like Supervisor Raybould mentioned, this is something that's we weren't faced with. It actually was first put in the 2012 codes when we adopted them, but we didn't have any construction going on of large buildings, so we didn't run into it like we have in the last few years. And it basically requires the building to have a radio system in it if the construction of the building precludes us from being able to use our radios. That's how we have to talk. It's a safety thing for us to be able to communicate with the incident commander outside the building. And some types of construction just kills the radio signal. So if that's the case, this just provides that the radio use in the building has to be as good as it is outside the building. So we don't make a business owner, if there's no radio signal outside the building, we don't make them put it inside. So we just have to have it as good as is outside the building. And there's already the ability for us to require a technical report for virtually any subject that we run into. This is just specifically to radios.
The next item is 901.11, which is on page 17. Allows the fire department to issue citations and fines if too many false alarms are received from a property, and that's in current code, isn't it?
It is. The modification was actually brought forward from Reno. In our municipal code, we already have the ability to charge for false alarms. Reno did not, and this was generated from, think of your long-term weekly rental hotels, motels, and people are smoking in the hallways underneath smoke alarms or smoke detectors in the hallways, and it sets off the alarms. So it's not really a false alarm because the system worked correctly, but it's behavior issues of the residents are causing false alarms. So this was a way they were trying to address that. We already have it in the municipal code, so it doesn't really impact us one way or the other.
Next item is 903.2.1.2, which is on page 18. and this will require sprinkler systems in all casinos, no matter what the size of the casino?
And again, that's a state law thing under NAC 477283.
Next is 903.2.2 footnote B. If I can find it. Fire areas may be separated. No. 503.
I'm on it, Brad.
Okay.
So what that is most houses are built under the International Residential Code. If a house is built under the International Building Code, it has to be sprinklered. The exceptions we have are only for the International Residential Code. So most houses are built under that. If it's over 5,000 square feet, we require sprinklers. So some folks with larger houses in the 7, 8, 9, 10,000 square foot homes, which we don't have that many, but occasionally we get them, don't want to put sprinkler systems in at times. And so they've tried to use parts of the regular International Building Code to create firewalls to create separate fire areas, because the way we measure the square footage in a house is by fire areas, without getting too deep into the weeds on that. It's basically the under roof area. So when you build firewalls, there can't be penetrations in it. You can't have your trusses go through it. There's all different kinds of things that complicate construction. So some of the departments around here, including us at one point, accepted that as an alternative means and methods to not have to put in the sprinklers. The problems we ended up with in construction were very complicated, and while we tried to explain those to the contractors and the property owners early on, you know, sometimes they have to figure it out for themselves. And it just created a lot of problems, and so we've stopped accepting it as an alternative means and methods. I can't think of any house that started down that road that didn't end up just putting the sprinklers in, because it ended up being cheaper than all the construction-related things they had to do for the firewall and all the associated things, like if you have HVAC duct running through it, now you have to put a fire damper in. It's quite expensive, and folks don't really realize that. So we wanted to put that in there so when contractors are looking at it, it's clear to them what the intent is, and we're trying to avoid delays in construction, basically.
Dave, will this also apply to commercial properties? And the other instance that I can think of, say you have a 4,500-square-foot house and you're going to do a 1,000 or a 1,500-square-foot addition to it, which would obviously trigger the sprinkler system. Could they construct, you know, would it pertain to that, or could they still construct a firewall for the addition so that it doesn't have to be sprinklered?
So the table that we're referring to only refers to buildings constructed under the IRC, so it doesn't affect commercial. That's a different table, and people that build commercial properties already understand all the different firewall things, and we don't have any issues there. And the Chipotle building in town that was built, I think, last year is a good example where they did that. The addressing your remodel question, if you had a 4,500-square-foot house, sprinklers wouldn't be triggered until two things: you're over 5,000 square feet, and also it's over 50% addition. So if you're just adding 1,500 square feet, you wouldn't trigger it.
Next is 903.2.3, requires fire sprinklers in all daycares with seven or more children and who are open between the hours of 12 a.m. and 6 a.m.
Again, that just mirrors the state law.
NAO 3.4.2 requires an alarm notification device in every tenant-occupied space rather than just on the exterior of a building. I thought you had a great response to that.
This is a carryover of the existing code, and I believe it was in our code even before the 2012 codes. The base sprinkler code just requires a bell on the outside of the building. If you think of think of Raley's or any big warehouse or big industrial building that we have, no one's going to hear the bell going off on the outside of the building. So we require at least one horn strobe inside the building. Usually it's at a common area, maybe at a reception desk or something like that. So if the sprinkler system does activate, someone inside the building is aware of it and they can let everybody know.
Section B-102, warehouses that use high racking to store flammable materials will now be labeled problem facilities.
So this really doesn't apply to us. This was brought forward by Truckee Meadows Fire. The fire code allows has a table of fire flow requirements in it. It also allows the use of NFPA 1142, which is an alternate way to calculate fire flow. Just specific other code document. In that code document, it specifically, within the scope, addresses what types of building NFPA 1142 can be used for, and it excludes certain ones. They were having some issues with large warehouses, think like Apple, Switch, you know, big million square foot places that are being built in areas that don't have adequate water infrastructure, and the 1142 is being inappropriately applied, so they asked that be put in there to clarify the language of the intent of NFPA 1142, which is a referenced document.
Thank you. Section B105.2, minimum fire flow requirements are doubled and reduced flow rates increased by 50%.
So the base codes make an assumption that all buildings are sprinklered, whether it's a house, a building, and most of them have a very low threshold for sprinklers. That isn't the case here locally. And in the past, the fire codes and state code, state fire code, have allowed a 50% reduction in fire flow requirements if the building is sprinklered, assuming that the fire is going to be kept small or maybe even put out. The new codes reduce that. They're given a 75% reduction in flow. So if you needed 10,000 gallons a minute, they're saying you could go down to 2,500 gallons a minute that we would use in our engines instead of 5,000. So internally, staff-wise, myself, the chief, and Chief Vaughn, the operations chief, we talked about it, and our recommendation is that it stay at 50%, and that was also the consensus of all the other departments around here. And the reason for that is that doesn't take into effect the degradation of water systems over time, where you might start off with you can provide 5,000 gallons a minute, but as the pipes shrink, just like our, arterial sclerosis, of the pipes, they get smaller and smaller over time, so in 10 or 20 years, what used to be able to provide enough fire flow may not. So if we skinny that down so much, it just doesn't really give us any room to work. So,
Dave, I just bring this up just because I've experienced this, and since this is a document that affects Douglas County as well, how are they dealing with the water lakefront homes and the fireboat? Because that's been an ongoing discussion about how much water pressure.
Well, I would fully support the city buying a fireboat for our Lake Tahoe properties. I know the fire chief would be right there with me on it. What Tahoe Douglas did is purchased a fireboat, and they're using that as an alternative way to provide the fire flows for those lakefront homes because there just isn't the waterfront or the water infrastructure to support it. So that's. And that document I mentioned earlier, NFPA 1142, there's some other ways that we can provide alternatives to just a regular underground utility and fire hydrant system.
So does that fireboat have a beer cooler? Moving on, section C102.2, maximum distance from a fire hydrant for a fire department connection cannot exceed 100 feet.
So this was an effort to standardize things. So fire department connection is that pipe with a little ear-looking thing that you see outside of a building that we hook our pumpers to pump into the fire sprinkler system. It's also used for standpipes. Some of the buildings in town, larger, taller buildings, the new 308 North Curry building, has standpipes, buildings that are too big for us to be able to just drag our hoses in right off the engine. It's too much hose, so we have a hose connection inside the building that we can connect to, and the pumper connects to it. The code requires that that FDC be within 100 feet of a hydrant for the standpipe ones, one where we hook our firefighting hoses to, but it's silent on connections to sprinkler systems. So we try to have them outside the collapse zone. We try to have them in a reasonable distance. So in an effort, and they've been doing this in Southern Nevada, that was also one of our efforts, was to try to, not to mirror what they're doing in Southern Nevada because we do it better up here, but to take some of the things that they're doing and try to have more of a statewide approach to things. So we looked at that as an effort to standardize that, and most of the time the hydrants are around that distance anyways. It just provides more guidance to engineers and designers.
Section 105.3, fire chief has sole authority to approve building materials, deleting the concurrent decision-making with the building official, and I thought you had a great explanation on this as well.
So the building department, while they help us enforce this, they don't adopt this code, just like we don't adopt the building code, so we deleted that. But we always work together with them and come up to joint decisions and joint solutions when we're working on these projects.
Table 503.1, footnote F, fire official has sole authority to determine approval of a non-conforming water supply. And this one, to me, is a big one because it seems like this keeps coming up in the wildland urban interface with new construction of homes where residents do not have a handle on what is going to be required as far as fire flow and fire supply. And I just talked to a lady the other day that was telling me that the required fire supply or water supply system that she's going to have to put in on a $500,000 house is close to $100,000 additional above and beyond the cost of the house. So this is an important one in our area.
So let me walk it back a little bit just so we start with a baseline. So the WUI code talks about conforming water supply and non-conforming water supply. And non-conforming water supply is basically one that doesn't meet the code requirements. Since as far as I can recall and I'm aware of, the entire time the WUI code's been adopted and our Title 14 prior to that, which incorporated some of the WUI code stuff, we have not allowed non-conforming water supply. I mean, there are prescriptive requirements in the code, and people have to meet them. And you can always apply alternative means and methods. There's other ways. As an example, would be if you build a 2,000 square foot house, and it's in an area with, let's say, over in Pinyon Hills, there's no hydrants. The prescriptive requirements is 1,000 gallons a minute for 30 minutes. 30,000 gallons of storage is what the code requires. We allow someone to sprinkle their home in lieu of having that stored water there as an alternative means and method, and that's pretty commonly what happens. So we don't allow non-conforming water supplies to begin with, right? That doesn't and it's in there because of politics. The codes are consensus documents as well, but if you have a water supply, you know, we have to follow what the code says for what that is. So the footnote you're talking about, the code provides for there's a provision where if you increase the defensible space to 1.5 times whatever's required, so let's say you had to have 100 feet of defensible space. If you increase it to 150 feet, what that does, it doesn't really have anything to do with the water supply. It has to do with the ignition-resistant classification. Without getting too deep into the weeds, there's three different kinds, and it's based on the fire severity. We have extreme fire around here. We have tons of red flag days and all the other things that go with it. So what that will do, there are some construction things related to the building materials that the person can reduce if they do that. And that's what that footnote and the footnote says, with the approval of the fire code official, right? And defensible space doesn't take care of every single issue that's out there. So it just provides for if if defensible space, maybe the 1.5 times doesn't do it, maybe you need more, maybe there's other issues related to the landscape, that it allows that code official to keep the base requirements in there and not let them reduce from the class 1 to class 2. So it doesn't really, it's not really affected by the water supply.
Dave, how does that relate to people that live in that wildland urban interface that have ponds? Is that considered an alternate water source, or it is not considered that?
It's actually considered a conforming water supply. It's an approved water source, and we have one under construction and one that was built last year that used ponds. And Brad, I would echo your frustration or concern with the wildland urban interface, because that's probably the biggest area where we end up having friction with builders. And part of it's because they're, you know, it's a small part of the city. A lot of times it's with builders that usually build in the urban areas, and they might have a project in the wildland urban interface, and they don't understand all the requirements. There's stuff in the hillside development standards that also trigger wildland urban interface stuff, and that's another area where we've tried to do outreach, and we're probably due to do it again. When Sean Keating was here, he and I did a pretty big outreach on WUI stuff with architects and contractors, and we're probably due to do that again. But there is a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of confusion on owner-builders, that especially when we get owner-builders that try to build. Maybe one of the folks you talked to was an owner-builder. I know there's two of them, two projects going in with owner-builders that are kind of confused about the requirements, and we've met with them and tried to explain everything. But it would be like me trying to negotiate a commercial realty contract. That's not what I do. I don't know about it. And it's hard because these folks aren't contractors, and there's a lot of moving parts. So we try to help them and educate them the best we can, but it is something that comes up a lot.
Actually, maybe even of Brad. So if there's a vacant piece of property in the WUI area, is that a disclosure in the real estate documents, so that people will understand they're going to come to a higher code? I just wonder if... You only do commercial. That was a good answer, huh?
Don't ask me residential questions.
But, you know, it just comes to my mind that it would be a good educational disclosure to people, so they, what's this mean? It's a more expensive code. That's what it means if you're going to build a house in that area. So it's just, you don't know. Okay. Just a thought.
Well, I can answer one thing, Lori, for you. I know the folks that we run into that end up buying the property and then coming to see us after they've already engaged an architect or a contractor did not know anything about it. And you know, unfortunately, it's something that their realtor should be doing on due diligence. And, I mean, it's on our website. It's on the city's GIS website. The WUI boundaries are shown. We try to put as many handouts on the building department website for construction in the WUI area. So, I mean, we try to just paper everything we can to have the information out there, but people don't always do their due diligence.
And the next item is similar and has to do with defensible space. It's section 603.2.1.1, adjacent land.
Sure. So, unfortunately, fire doesn't know any property boundaries, and this is a carryover from the last adoption we did back in 2013. They do it up at the lake as well. This is kind of an outcome of the Waterfall Fire and the Angora Fire recommendations that came out of the Bi-State Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission. And if Lori does her defensible space really well, but on either side of her, the vacant lots are there that I own, have sagebrush 10 feet tall, that it's not really helping her. And so this requires the vacant property owner next to improved parcels, whatever that defensible space boundary is that goes over onto their property, that they maintain that. And when we did it, I think the last time we did inspections on those was a couple years ago, there was about 100, maybe just over 100 parcels citywide that it affected, and everybody was cooperative. Typically, it only involves mowing maybe a 10, 15-foot strip right around the property line, because people don't usually have their houses that close to the property line where you know, it's a 50-foot incursion into the vacant lot next door. So we haven't issued any citations. Everyone was cooperative, and it's been pretty effective program.
Right, and you did answer that that everybody's been cooperative, but I'd like to follow that down that path a little ways. If someone is not cooperative, then what is the process? Like, how far down this road would we go if somebody refuses to cooperate or they refuse to spend the money to enforce the defensible space?
Well, I mean, certainly we would work with them as much as we can. The last thing we want to do is have our staff tied up in court. And I'd say 99% of the time that we're successful in education and helping the folks. There's other alternatives we would maybe if they were elderly or indigent, we may be able to help them with some city resources as a partnership. There's lots of different things. But in the end, the municipal code does give us the authority to cite them and take them to court to enforce the action. And I would turn over to my colleague to the right to continue that conversation.
The mean one.
He summed it up really well. A citation would be issued, and then we would just go through the court process. And then hopefully at that point the person would comply, because at that point it's pretty serious. I mean, it's always serious. You need defensible space, so hopefully they wouldn't get to that point. But
so the process would be the same, say, as the nuisance ordinance?
It would be similar. It's the same process as far as citation. Then they would have their arraignment and plead guilty or not guilty. Sentencing if they pled guilty. If they pled not guilty, we would go through a bench trial. It takes a little bit, but it's a good process.
So let's just hope everybody remains cooperative.
Absolutely.
I'm to my last one. 604.5 non-combustible areas. This one surprised me, because what it states is that you cannot use any combustible materials within 5 feet of a structure. And so that includes landscape bark, fencing, pine needles, things of that. I had no idea, frankly.
So this is a direct outcome of the Angora fire and the governor's bi-state commission recommendations, and it's been adopted regionally. Most of the time, like I said in my earlier response to you, the fires lost in a wildfire aren't lost because of direct flame contact. It's lost because of the ember shower that precedes the fire front. Lands next to the house, lands on the roof. If you have pine needle and debris on your roof, it can burn through. The 5 foot zone, most of the houses that were lost in the Angora fire were due to ember showers landing next to the house in wood piles or pine needle beds, things like that. And the fire starts there, burns up the wall, goes into the attic space under the eave where there's eave vents, or into the foundation vents and starts the house on fire. So this was a way to not have pine needle straw right up against the house, not have bark mulch right up against the house. And actually, the Living with Fire folks that you see once a year when we come for Nevada Wildfire Awareness Month, the UNR Cooperative Extension, we did a test. That was 08 or 09 maybe. I don't remember exactly which year. Out at the airport, where we burned about 8 different types of bark mulch, or different mulches. And bark mulch is bad. It catches fire really easily. So we're not saying we want it to look like a prison and have raked sand or anything like that. There's other alternatives, from rocks to DG to other non-combustible landscape stuff. I'm certainly not a landscape expert. And it doesn't mean you can't have plants there. You can certainly have your petunias or whatever it is that you want. They just have to be irrigated and well-watered. We just want to avoid having that 5 foot band of combustible material that embers are going to land in and set the house on fire.
Great. I want to thank you for your patience with all my questions. It's been very educational for me, and hopefully very educational for the public.
Dave, thank you. You did a great job, and Iris as well. Is there any other board comment with regards to this?
Just in general, you indicated that a lot of this was to bring it into compliance with the NAC. When was that adopted? So was that like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and this is just a big catch-up of that too?
It's not to bring it into compliance with NEC. It's to mirror some of the NEC requirements so they're in the document. It's easier for contractors to find, if that makes sense.
It just helps to indicate that there probably isn't a lot of impact potentially to construction because they already had to comply with the NAC, right? So maybe that will help me understand why we can say there isn't an impact. Well, because they're already complying with 80% of this. I mean, I guess that's what I'm after is what are we doing anything more stringent than the state code that would actually have an impact? Just the one, right, where we're not going to reduce the 75%. We're going to keep it at 50, but we're doing that as existing code.
I'll try to answer your question. The contractors already have to follow the NAC, that's state law. Our amendments are more restrictive than what state law has, and that's to address our local conditions of climate, staffing levels, things like that. So the amendments that we adopt regionally are more restrictive than what the state adopts. The state adopts kind of at a 50,000-foot level, and then in the north we adopt, you know, down more at ground level, and Clark County does the same thing down there with all the jurisdictions where they have Southern Nevada amendments, so it that are specific to the issues they have in the Southern Nevada.
In the future, I just think it would be kind of nice to see where we're being more restrictive, because I think when you send out the notices to people, that might be helpful for them too to go, okay, you think the code is blah 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 blah, but in Carson City, due to this condition, we're going to be more restrictive, just so it's very clear for impacts. That's all. Just want to make sure we're always as transparent as possible. Thank you for your great work.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And I just want to say I appreciate the collaborative approach, especially with our area around here and wildfire danger and so forth. I think it was comprehensive in terms of the look that was taken to it.
And Lori, I would just say that these amendments apply to all the Northern Nevada areas, not Carson City.
I know. Our job, though, is to send the business impact to the Carson City businesses. So I agree with you, and I like that it's regional, because I think that's also a very good positive for builders. And right.
Is there any public comment to this? All right. If not, I'll take it back to the board.
Bill number?
115.
I move to introduce on first reading Bill number 115, an ordinance amending sections of Title 14, Chapter 14.02, to reflect the adoption of the 2018 editions of the International Fire Code, the International Wild Urban Interface Code, and the Northern Nevada Fire Amendments.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you again very much. We're going to take about a 10-minute break and be right back. right. We're on to item 16A, Health and Human Services, to approve a Carson City Health and Human Services acceptance of the Notice of Award for a Title 10 Family Planning Services Grant. Nikki and Ronnie.
Good morning. Nikki Aker, Director of Carson City Health and Human Services. So we are here to ask for the board's acceptance or approval for acceptance of our Title 10 grant. It is a seven-month grant, and that's what they're doing across the country. That's not just us. It is across the country is seven-month grants at this point. And within our grant, we are also sub-granting Douglas County $54,653. That does take into account, we have built in some of Ronnie, the clinical manager's time, to monitor the grant, and also we have built in a fiscal component within the grant.
Hey, Nikki, Lori?
Just one general question. When will you be applying for the next round? Because I thought it was strange that this ended in March, which doesn't even match the federal fiscal year. So when does that period start for application?
So we're hearing that it may be about October that they'll release the funding announcement, and we get to start working on it again.
Seems like a lot of extra paperwork. Any other board questions? Any public comment with regards to this item? All right, board.
I move to approve the acceptance of the Notice of Award for the Title 10 grant and to authorize the sub-grant award to Douglas County in the amount discussed on the record by Ms. Aker.
Motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
On to item 17A for possible action to approve an amendment to the land use map of the master plan to redesignate a 3.94-acre parcel of land from industrial to community regional commercial, a property located at 1588 Old Hot Springs Road. Hope?
Can we take 17A and B together?
Certainly. We will take items 17A and B together since they're related.
Thank you. Hope Sullivan, Planning Manager. What's before you today? The applicant is requesting to redesignate a 3.94-acre property that is currently designated in the master plan as industrial to community regional commercial, as well as to rezone the property from general industrial to tourist commercial. So there are two requests before you. One is a master plan amendment, and the second is a zoning map amendment. These would be voted on separately. As the aerial shows, the subject property is to the east of the Hot Springs. This will essentially revert the property to the designations that were in place in 2015. In 2015, the thinking was that given the freeway had removed access from Old Hot Springs to areas that were to the west and had not incorporated on and off ramps, this area would not thrive with commercial uses. It actually has thrived with commercial uses to the extent it is commercially zoned. In 2015, Sassafras Restaurant took occupancy of the vacant restaurant to the west of the Hot Springs. In 2016, the Hot Springs remodeled the bathrooms. In 2017, Shoe Tree Brewing Company constructed a brewery and tasting room, and the Hot Springs currently has a building permit pending for a new spa. In both 2016 and 2018, we had major project reviews for RV parks in the area, both on the subject property and on the property behind Sassafras. On August 29th, the Planning Commission reviewed both of these requests, and based on the ability to make the required findings, voted 5-0 with one absent to recommend approval. The applicant, Angela Fuss, is here, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Hope. Any board questions on this issue?
I actually thought it was a great presentation, and I don't have any questions for a change.
I would have to agree with that comment. Is there any public comment with regards to this? Good morning.
Good morning, Supervisors.
just press the button, if you would, and state your name.
Yes, Richard Langson. I represent the Langson family here in Carson City. We've been here for about 60 years, and we own the majority of the property around the Hot Springs and the Hot Springs. The family is for this change, zoning change. There used to be an RV park where it's anticipated to build the new one, and it was kind of a subpar RV park if you go back that far. And I've seen the plans. It's a much upgraded version, upscale, and we're totally for that. We've done quite a bit of building in Carson City. You may remember the Parkway Manor, very nice apartment project. So this is would complement the area, and I think it's a perfect use for the property.
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Sorry. Good morning. For the record, Angela Foose with Loomis & Associates here today on behalf of the applicant. I just want to echo both what Hope and the property owner have said. There have been quite a few changes in the past few years. There's a lot of new energy coming into this neighborhood, and it's all very positive. And so I think this really ties in with what's happening, and it's very complementary to the restaurant and the brewery and the hot springs. And I think it makes for a very cohesive design. So I think, unless you have any questions, we are definitely in favor. And we're looking forward to moving forward with the future project. Thank you.
Any other public comment? All right, board.
I move to approve an amendment to the land use map of the master plan to redesignate 3.94 acres of land from industrial to community regional commercial on property located at 1588 Old Hot Springs Road. Assessor's parcel number 008-123-23, based on the findings contained in the staff report to the Planning Commission.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor? Aye. Aye. All right. And do we want to take 17B? Yeah.
Bill number 116. I move to introduce on first reading Bill number 116, an ordinance approving a change of zoning from general industrial to tourist commercial on property located at 1588 Old Hot Springs Road, Assessor's parcel number 008-123-23, based on the findings contained in the staff report to the Planning Commission.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. Thank you. All right. Hope you're up again. This is to approve a master plan amendment to create a new spa, Blackstone Ranch specific plan for 26.89 acres of existing Lampa Ranch. And we can, since 17C and D are related, we'll take those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is a request for a master plan amendment as well as a zoning map amendment. On August 2nd, the Board of Supervisors considered this specific plan, the Blackstone Ranch specific plan, as well as the zoning map amendment. During that review, the Board of Supervisors recommended a modification to the Planning Commission's recommendation concerning the master plan. Specifically, the Board of Supervisors suggested that there be public secondary access to the site, whereas the recommendation of the Planning Commission was that the secondary access could be emergency only, provided the level of service at the intersection of Railroad and Salomon met city standards. Because the Board of Supervisors made a recommendation different than the recommendation received by the Planning Commission, the matter was referred back to the Planning Commission only for the item that you modified. The Planning Commission agreed with the Board of Supervisors that it was a good idea to have two points of access, and to be a little more specific, what the board said was initially that secondary access could be built to a lesser standard, but at the time of build-out, it needed to meet city standard. What the Planning Commission thought was rather than waiting till full build-out to meet city standard, it should meet city standard at 75% build-out. The applicant has agreed to that. So I want to just go through kind of sequentially what that will look like because there was some confusion in the public on that. First, what we're doing today is we're adopting the specific plan, and what I keep calling that is the rules of the game. So nobody can develop till we know what our rules are, right? You just went through a bunch of fire rules that everybody has to comply with. So that's what we're figuring out right now. Once we figure that out, the staff will review what's called a conceptual subdivision map. That means a developer comes in and shows us how he or she wants to subdivide the land. The staff would then review that map against the rules that the board adopts and determine to what extent it's in compliance and advise what was changes are necessary to achieve compliance. After that meeting, which is just an internal meeting with the staff, the applicant can seek a tentative subdivision map. There's been some confusion in the community whether or not we've received that. We have not received an application for a tentative subdivision map. When that's received, that will go before the Planning Commission as well as the Board of Supervisors. Again, we will review all the requirements of the specific plan and the zoning code, and we'll look at the findings and make a recommendation to the Planning Commission. Planning Commission will make a recommendation to Board. Board has the authority to approve the tentative map. At that point, the applicant would build the infrastructure, all the utilities, the roads, so on and so forth. And once the infrastructure is constructed or bonded for, they could then seek come to the Board of Supervisors for final map approval. It's not until the final map is recorded that anyone can start building houses, because the lots, well, they could technically build a single house there right now, but the lots aren't created until the final map's recorded. So I want to go over that sequencing. The actual wording I have posted, but it's in your packet as well. And again, what the staff worked to do, and Dan Stuckey and Stephen Pote were instrumental in helping craft this language, is identify a lesser standard for the initial public access with an upgrade to city standards at 75% build out. And as I mentioned, the applicant has agreed to this language. And Michelle Rambeau is present to represent the applicant. And I'm happy to answer questions. Oh, I forgot to tell you. On May 30th, the Planning Commission voted 6-1 to recommend amending the master plan as proposed, and they also voted 6-1 to recommend amending the zoning map.
Thank you, Hope. Any board questions? Brad?
I guess my only comment would be this is like our fifth go-around at this now that has gone back and forth, so I think that I'm finally satisfied with it.
Thank you for mentioning the time frame. I just want to put on the record that although you did introduce an ordinance to amend the zoning map, because more than 45 days has passed, we're back to first reading on that. Thank you.
Right.
I think I do. I just want to comment on it's never about a rush to get something done. It's about doing it right. So I want to thank the residents, too, for working as a team member. It was a really nice mix between the developer and the homeowners. I think that we came up, and as a board, I think we did a pretty good job coming up with a reasonable accommodation for all. So I'm very happy with where we've landed.
And I, too, appreciate the residents' active participation in this process. That's great. All right. Is there any public comment with regards to this? Just press the mic and then state your name.
I pushed the button. I was confused that there could be a specific plan without a specific secondary road. That just messed me up. You guys play by a whole different set of rules. The only other rule that I would like to add to this thing, if that's possible, and I love it, that at the outset, the secondary road, wherever it may be, gets built ASAP right away. That's the first thing before we get going. And I understand that you're going to use Railroad Drive to get into that pasture to build wherever that specific road is, that second road. Once it's built, can you make it so that no more construction vehicles go down Railroad Drive? So that there are no dump trucks going down there, no bulldozers going down rail. They use that secondary road. Can we do that? Is that a possibility?
I believe that that's something that would be addressed when the tentative map application is submitted. It would be a condition to the tentative map.
Okay. So let me ask you this then. For you guys, is this unreasonable? It's not?
I don't know until we know where they're going to put the secondary road.
Yeah, we'd have to see the application for the tentative subdivision map first.
Right.
Okay. Well, at least you are aware of my bias and my hope.
We're tuned in.
I think that what you will see is the same process when the tentative map comes in that we have gone through here, and that everybody's going to have a chance for public input, and all the parties will come together to come up with a reasonable solution.
Thank you.
Rick, would you put your name on the record for us, though, just so that it can be recorded? Just state your name.
Okay. Do I speak it, or do I write it? Yeah. I'm Rick Riondo. I go by Old Rick because I'm a little cranky. It's not easy being a curmudgeon, and you need to know that. I spell Riondo, R-I-E-N-D-E-A-U. Thanks.
You guys are very patient.
I am very grateful. This is all new to me, and I have been coached here some. Thank you. Oh, button.
For the record, I'm Jim Flegel. I just want to, it sounds like the whole thing here is the secondary access, which is what we all want to see. The infrastructure, I assume, will be all the utilities, the roads, and stuff like that. So, you know, if the secondary access is built at that point, that's great. I guess the other question is, what's the difference between rural and city standard? Just curb, gutter, sidewalk?
Curb, gutter, sidewalk, yes.
Other than that, when they lay the asphalt and the gravel and stuff, that'll all be, I'll just say city standards, but, you know, until the curb, gutter, sidewalk goes in, it won't be a city road. Okay, thank you. I'm clear now.
Thank you for your comments. Is there any other public comment? All right, seeing none, what's the pleasure of the board?
I move to approve a master plan amendment to create a new specific plan area, Blackstone Ranch specific plan, for 26.89 acres of existing Wampa Ranch specific plan area, located at the east end of Railroad Drive and west of Interstate 580, assessor's parcel number 010-051-44, subject to the incorporation of the modified language to policies 3.1.2b, 3.1.2C, and 3.6C, as recommended by the Planning Commission.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. Thank you, and we will take the next 17D as well.
I move to introduce on first reading Bill Number 117, an ordinance approving a change of zoning from agriculture to single-family 6000 on property located at the east end of Railroad Drive and west of Interstate 580, assessor's parcel number 010-051-44.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Hope. Appreciate that.
Good work, everyone.
Good work, all. Last up, City Manager. Nancy, you're going to present your report.
All right, so upcoming events on October 6th, we have the community flu vaccinations, and those will be in the parking lot north of the DMV. October 27th, which everyone probably knows, is Nevada Day 2018. And then on November 9th, they're doing a dedication of Battleborn, a memorial to Nevada's fallen military. And this ceremony will be held on the Capitol grounds outside of the Nevada State Library and Archives at 10 a.m.
Nancy, mm-hmm. Are we trying to do, just so people know, the Friday on a Curry Street grand opening and event?
Yes, I believe they're working on the opening on that Friday.
Right, yes. Just so everyone's aware to mark that on your calendars.
And okay. I can bring back more information on the next one on that. So. Okay, under legislative activities, city staff is working with our federal lobbyists to develop language for inclusion in the Nevada Technical Corrections Bill. And this will allow us to make some corrections to the 2009 lands bill. There were parcels that weren't transferred but probably should have been, and some that were transferred that are turning into kind of a maintenance nightmare for the city or are better suited, you know, for non-public use. So the Parks Department and the city's property manager will be bringing a presentation back for the board in October on that. So on community development, the permit valuation for August was $15.3 million for a total year-to-date amount of $66 million. There was $40 million for residential, $8 million in new commercial and industrial, and $18 million in commercial and industrial remodel and miscellaneous. Just for reference, the total for calendar year 2017 was $69 million. And then on the residential permits activity for the month of August, housing permits issued included 11 single-family detached and 60 multifamily. This is a total of 194 residential permits for the calendar year, with 2017 being 140.
Nancy or Lee, that 60 multifamily permits is part of the project behind Fandango, which is 372 total. Do they still anticipate pulling all those permits this year?
Lee says no, they don't expect to pull all of them this year. So that's for three 20-unit buildings up there. All right, the next three items are scheduled for review by the Planning Commission on September 26th. This is a tentative plan for a hotel at West Appian Street and Patrick and South Carson. This is Lompa Ranch North, a tentative subdivision map to create 204 single-family residential lots on approximately 58 acres on property zoned single-family 6,000 and multifamily duplex. This is a tentative subdivision map to create 18 condominium hangar units at the Carson City Airport. This one is a building permit under review for a Chick-fil-A in South Carson, I think close to Highway 50. And then this is a building permit that's under review for an O'Reilly Auto Parts store on Highway 50 East. And then this is, again, the building permits have been issued for three 20-unit buildings at Clearview and South Curry. So IFC activity for August 8th through September 5th. Again, this is mostly just approving the filling of vacant positions. Supervisor Bagwell had asked me to, we're still trying to work on a report, exactly how to report that, but I did run the job postings that were still open, and there's five right now that are still open, and then the other ones are just in the process, various processes of, you know, hiring, interviewing, and that. So, and then items coming out of the Capital Projects Fund and the undesignated. The first one is we approved the repair of the City Hall parking lot on North Plaza and East Proctor. That was to address property damage and safety concerns. I don't know if you've been in that lot, but it's very hard to maneuver, and the, yeah, narrow, and the spaces aren't large enough, so that will be $20,000. Yeah, I think there's been probably some door dings going on over there. So the next one is repair to the linear ditch pathway. Right now it's currently closed due to safety concerns, and that will be $10,875. And then the last one.
Nancy, I have a question on that. It looks like some of the erosion is being backfilled with dirt and not sand or gravel. I'm just wondering why that's being done and it's not being done with the same materials that the path was originally constructed with.
We might get back to you, but Jen might have an answer.
Thank you, Jennifer Budge, Parks and Recreation Director. I'm actually kind of confused because we haven't started the project, so we haven't done any backfilling or repairs.
So, well, maybe it's farther up the lineal path then because it's in the part that's open south of Rattlesnake Hill.
Okay, we can look at that section. The section that's closed right now is between Fremont and the freeway, and that's the section that will be repaired with those funds that are identified. But I can check into the other section and wonder if we have some helpers working on it that we're not aware of. Yeah, because I'm not aware of any other or backfilling or any other activities on that path. Thank you.
Okay, the last item is to replace landscaping at the senior center. This is the last step in the project to repair the structural damage that occurred at the senior center on the eastern portion, and that's going to be $16,958.
So, Nancy, how much then would we have left in the break fix after you approve those?
You know what? I'll have to email you that because I forgot to get that information from Sherry. Sorry.
There was also an insurance claim on this. So is this also covered under the insurance, or is this – so will there be a reimbursement down the road on this, or is this coming out of our pocket?
It's coming out of our pocket. I don't believe we had received any insurance reimbursement on this.
It was a discussion item to try and get insurance, and we got told no, right?
Right, they didn't provide
it
coverage.
Wasn't.
Yeah. That was it.
Thank you, Nancy. All right. We are on to non-action items. Any future agenda items? Any board reports, anything?
And just one comment. There was an affordable housing forum last week. Lori was there as well. And I was one of the panel members at that discussion. And I kind of felt like the public that was there did not hear the message that was being relayed at that forum, which is that there are no easily attainable fixes to affordable housing. I think a lot of the feedback that we got from the public was, you're the government, just fix this. And it's Lee was also on the panel. And I think that the message that was trying to be relayed was that it's not that easy. This is a very complex issue, has to do with multiple parties that have to work together. And although there may be an opportunity for us to sit down and work together, there's no real easy solutions other than the government stepping in with some big subsidies. But that's not the feeling that I got. That was the message I got taken away from that. So I'd be interested in feedback from people to see what they took away and see if I just am misreading them or not.
I think one of the takeaways that I got from the forum was there was several residents that thought we had a project on Brown Street and it could just get accomplished to meet some of this. So I'm not so sure we don't need an educational discussion on some of the properties that we have available that Carson City has to be able to offer properties for development that could be for workforce housing. And so I think they just, in their minds, have had Brown Street. And like you said, we should just do it. And it's more complicated than people recognize. And so I think we have some educational aspects to do.
I would just like to add to that, I'd like the state to be part of the conversation as well because it's a statewide problem. It's not just Carson City. And, you know, they need to come to the table and all need to work together because you're right, it's going to take everyone working together to try and arrive at a solution.
Well, and the public public should be aware regarding the Brown Street project that that would require eminent domain, and I'm not sure that there's many people that want to go down that road.
I think they didn't realize, you know, and so I think they just thought all along with NHRA, Rural Housing Authority, that there was a foregone conclusion and that we dropped the ball. They didn't realize there's some property owners that want to keep their property. So I agree with you.
Any other, Nancy?
I forgot I could look up the break fix, and there's approximately 341,000 left.
Is any of that committed but not spent yet?
No, that's all undesignated.
Do we have anything from the DA that needs to be brought up?
No, everything is going well.
Good. That's a good thing. Thank you. All right, then. One final public comment. Oh, Brad?
Yeah. Sorry, I want to backtrack. Dan, you just reminded me. We actually have submitted a letter to the state regarding the licensing of any additional marijuana dispensaries in Carson City, because there's a lot of groups that are out tying up property right now in anticipation of being able to get licensed for an additional dispensary. And the Carson City ordinance, which the letter was to make this clear to everybody involved, we have 4 current licenses, 2 medicinal, 2 recreational. And our ordinance states that a dispensary has to have both licenses and they have to be co-located at the same location. So there is no opportunity for anybody to come back and get an additional license for a dispensary in Carson City at this time without us changing the ordinance. My understanding is that there's probably not any appetite for that ordinance to be changed by this board. So I just wanted to put that on the record for anybody that might be out there looking to tie up locations, because they've called our office, at least 5 groups have called our office and actually argued with me saying that they can get a license, and that is not the case.
So thank you for bringing that up. I absolutely agree with that assessment legally, that we've met that cap. And so any person who's interested currently or in the future, unless there is a change in our local ordinance, that is not a possibility. So that's the content of the letter that was went out to the Department of Taxation for purposes of them sending out that same notice to other interested parties. My understanding in working with the city manager's office is that letter will also be posted on the city's website. This is just all preemptive in nature. It's sort of a courtesy notice to members of the public. It's for full transparency and to let everyone know, if you're contemplating doing this, don't waste your time, don't waste your efforts, and don't expend resources on it, because it's not going to happen here in Carson City unless there's a change in local ordinance.
Dan, can I just ask this question, in that I've been contacted as well by one group in particular who is working with the tribes. That does not apply to our regulations, correct?
That is correct. Based on my reading and understanding of the law, the tribe being a sovereign nation, you know, in and of itself, it has no overlap with the city's ordinances with respect to those regulations.
Any further public comment? Then do we have a motion to adjourn? We're adjourned. Thank you.